You're listening to Confronting Christianity, a podcast of Training the Church. There are all sorts of ways in which actually the things the Bible was telling us 2,000 years ago are borne out by the findings of modern psychology, including the goodness of going to church every week.
But if I'm going to faithfully articulate my position, I can't articulate a non-evolutionary view of the human person by looking at the evolutionary view and being like, they're all just people who think we came from monkeys. It's not going to hold up.
It's fine to acknowledge when we don't know. And I think it's an opportunity for us to kind of field our whole team as Christians.
This is Kyle Worley, and I'm joined by my co-host, Rebecca McLaughlin. How's it going, Rebecca?
Greetings.
Eating a Kit Kat?
Well, I'm eating a mini Kit Kat, so it's going okay.
Well, where does Kit Kat rank in your candy bar ratings?
Gosh, tied for first place in my heart and mouth.
Okay.
Are Lindor, like the red Lindor chocolates, so the milk chocolate.
Okay.
And Cadbury's cream eggs.
Oh, I love Cadbury. Those are delicious.
Have I ever told you the most romantic thing my husband ever did for me?
No, tell me.
So after Easter, Brian, my husband is, you know, amongst other things, very cheap. I say this in a loving, like I appreciate this about him. And he knows I love Kirby's Cream Eggs. So he'll often go after Easter when they go on discount and he'll buy me a bunch. So to see me through the coming months.
Yep.
And a few years ago, he had gone to Target with the express desire to buy these Cadbury's cream eggs for me. And when he came back, he said, oh, I'm really sorry, they're all sold out. And I was like, oh, gosh. Like, I was truly looking forward to these Cadbury's cream eggs. They were gone. The next morning I woke up and my first thought was, oh, I'm sad. I'm not going to have a Cadbury's cream egg today. I walked downstairs. And I go to get my breakfast cereal, which is the time was sort of Special K with red berries. And I pick up my box of Special K, and it is very heavy. And what I realize is that Brian, in fact, lied to me. There were Cadbury's cream eggs.
Amazing.
And he filled my breakfast cereal box with these Cadbury's cream eggs so that they would surprise me in the morning. Isn't that delightful?
That's awesome. Way to go, Brian.
Love him.
Wow, what a man.
It's like a once in a decade gesture, to be clear, but still.
Sure, but you remember it.
Mm-hmm.
You remember
it. Oh, I do.
I love that. I love that. Now, you just got back from across the pond, as they say. It's across the pond geographically for you, but in your heart of hearts, does it feel like across the pond, or does it feel like when you go to the UK, you're like, yes, I've returned home, and life over here is across the pond?
Do you know, that's a really good question, because for actually many years after we moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, I felt like it didn't feel like home here, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was because Cambridge is a very transient town. Sure. And so I'd make friends every year and then they'd leave. And then I'd make friends and then they'd leave. And I thought, you know, one day I'm going to age out of this. Please let me age out of this. I hate this so much. And now as I come home, I mean, there are definitely senses in which I feel very at home in England. And I have a beloved family in England as well and beloved friends. But it's really nice that now I truly feel like this strange country, or the tiny corner in this strange country in which I live, feels like home, because not only is my immediate sort of family, you know, my husband and my kids here, but my extended church family and neighbors. And there are so many ways in which it does feel like home. So I feel profoundly thankful for that.
I love that. Now, you were over there doing some talks. Where were you speaking at?
I have a hard time even formulating this word, but I was speaking at Oxford, which I don't know what the equivalent rivalry, like think of whatever college you went to.
Okay.
Think of the college that your college most hated.
Sure.
And that is me and Oxford, because I was at Cambridge for 7 years. So Oxford is, we call Oxford the other place.
Okay.
Apparently call Cambridge that as well. Yeah.
That you really call it the other place, or you're substituting that in for a really nasty place?
No. Okay. We literally call, like, it's reciprocal.
Okay.
People at Cambridge call Oxford the other place, and likewise.
Okay. All right. So, but what were your talks? They weren't that you're certainly you didn't go there and give talks about how junky Oxford is. Did you?
No, I wish, okay. I wish I could have done. no, I talked on a few entirely non-controversial topics, as like is my wont. Like, well, the first, let me see if I can remember them in order. A human's better off without religion was number one. Sure. Then has Christianity been science disproved Christianity?
Sure.
Is Christianity opposed to diversity? Sure. Is Christianity a hindrance to justice and equality? And how can a loving God allow people to suffer?
Wow, Rebecca is always picking those softballs.
That's right.
Well, okay. So you left your home. You left your precious kiddos. You left precious Cadbury giving Brian, yeah. And you went to England to give talks about big ideas.
This is true.
Okay.
Was that a question?
I'm getting there. I just paused for a dramatic effect.
Just verifying. Okay.
So ideas matter to you. Yes or no?
Absolutely.
Okay. You did. Now the audience may not know this, but you did your PhD in what?
Well, apparently you don't know it either.
No, I do know. I do know. I'm hosting okay. an episode of this podcast. Playing the part of the audience right now.
Listen carefully. I did my PhD on prisons in Shakespeare.
Prisons in Shakespeare. Mm. Okay. You spent a number of years in graduate education. I'm sure somebody, either you or the college or your parents or someone, spent some money. You've written how many books now?
I think I'm on number 10.
10 books. You've spoken at many places. You run a podcast. You believe ideas matter. And you've really given a significant amount of your life to thinking and then like putting those thoughts down so other people can think. When we think about big ideas, I think that right now we're in a place, we're in a time, and again, I can only speak from like what life is like in the global West. I know that maybe some people in our global audience hate that I caveat that. I want you to always know I do that so that I'm not out there speaking for the global East and the global South.
Yeah.
I want to hear from the voices in those places telling me what life is like there. I don't want to tell you what life is like in the global East where I do not live, minister, write, think, practice my faith. So that's why I do it, is just to acknowledge where I'm at and to acknowledge Rebecca and I are not subject matter experts on the global experience of all people.
Agreed.
But we're in the global West. And I feel like we're in a moment right now where there are two temptations. One, ideas are insignificant. Just live. It's almost a kind of like, whether it's spiritualized or not, it's either a hedonism or an agnosticism, where it's just kind of like, just live your life, do your thing. Ideas aren't really that important. Have fun or be private. But that's one temptation. Treat ideas as insignificant. The second is treat every topic, every question, like it is a battleground and there's only one winner and everyone else is a bloody loser. Like those are the ditches on either side of conversations right now. And I wanted to do an episode where we just ask this question that I feel like Christians maybe don't think through or haven't been asked to think through, but I think it's important for us, which is, can Christians even argue about ideas? Like, can we argue about ideas? If somebody disagrees with us about something, can we argue about it? I mean, just what would you, like, let's just start there. Can we argue ideas? As Christians?
Yes, but
okay.
when we say the word argue, that can mean a whole lot of different things.
Let's talk about it.
A kid could say, my parents were arguing last night. Typically what they mean is not, my parents were having a reasoned discussion about an interesting idea. Typically what they mean is, my parents were having a massive fight that was incredibly destructive and upsetting for all of us.
Yep.
And Christians, the way that Christians engage in arguments about ideas or disagree, like, attempted persuasion on topics about which we disagree would be a kind of long rambling way of kind of recasting that word of arguing. I think it mattered profoundly how we argue.
Right.
And I love what Peter says in 1 Peter, I believe it's 3:15, that we Christians should always be willing and ready to give a reason for the hope that we have, but that we should do so with gentleness and respect.
Yeah.
And I think whether we are engaging with brothers and sisters inside the church on topics that we may profoundly disagree about, or whether we're engaging with people outside the church, our arguments, if we're going to use that word, should be characterized by gentleness and respect. Mm-hmm. But then what do I mean by those two things? I mean, gentleness is relatively self-evident, mm-hmm. that we should not be mean. We shouldn't be seeking to tear other people down personally. We should be mm-hmm. attending to the other person's feelings in a conversation.
Sure.
So what does respect mean? Some people say, well, in order to respect somebody else, if they have different beliefs, I need to affirm their different beliefs as equally valid to mine.
Yeah.
I actually don't think that's what respect means. Mm-hmm. If you and I, Kyle, are disagreeing about something, like say, you know, if we ever bothered to really fight about it, we disagree about baptism.
Sure.
You know, I would be glad to baptize my kids as babies, though I didn't get to for various reasons, including going to a Baptist church.
Sure.
And you have been described by some, I believe, as Capti Bapti.
I have, yep. Mm-hmm.
So in order to respect each other, we don't have to agree and acknowledge that, like, the other person is probably just as right as we are. Mm-hmm. What we do need to do is to say, okay, I am going to give Kyle the benefit of the doubt, and I'm going to pay him the respect of thinking that he probably, like me, has searched the scriptures on this issue. He probably, like me, has real convictions around this issue that he has come to after serious thought and consideration, and after engaging with people's ideas on the other side.
Sure.
Saying, actually, you and I believe the same thing about baptism wouldn't be respect, because it's not acknowledging the reality of your views. And that's, you know, one example among many.
Yeah.
Where I think we need to say, do you know what? And one of the professors at my seminary in London put this really well. He said, you know, people often say you have to respect other people's ideas. He said that's not true at all. People believe all sorts of crazy things. You need to respect other people.
Right.
And I think we can all tell when we're in a conversation where we personally are being respected.
Yep.
And when we're in fact being denigrated.
That's right.
And I, both with Christian friends and with non-Christian friends, like, one of the things I actually really enjoy, I mean, my husband Brian sometimes like laughs at me about this. A friend called Lydia, who's a very intelligent woman, who's now a professor at Columbia University. And when Brian and I first went to visit Lydia and her family together, Brian commented after the evening, he said, oh, you and Lydia basically spend most of your time arguing. And I said, yeah, isn't it great? Like, it's like fantastic. Mm-hmm. I get to wrestle through a whole lot of things with somebody who I know is extremely intelligent, mm-hmm. very well thought through, a very serious sister in Christ, who will tell me when she thinks I'm wrong. And that's a delightful blessing to have.
It is. It is. And I do think that distinction, like, I think Christians of all people can say unequivocally, the dignity of other people, the humanity of other people is not conditional on what they believe or don't believe.
Yes.
There's no such thing as conditional dignity. The Christian believes everybody is an image bearer of God, and their dignity is not up for discussion in terms of what they believe or don't believe. At the same time, we can disagree with other people, Christian or non-Christian, without disrespecting or undignifying who they are as image bearers of God. It's possible to say, I disagree with you. I think you're wrong. And to say it in such a way where you go, I'm not telling you that you're not an image bearer of God. I'm not telling you that you're not somebody who loves and is capable of being loved. I'm not saying that you're somebody of whom there is no worth or value. I am merely saying that on this one thing that we're talking about, I disagree with you.
Yeah, and I think one of the ways that we can show real love and respect in a conversation where we're talking with somebody who maybe profoundly disagrees with us on an important issue is to help them, I don't want to say this in a condescending way, but to engage with the best possible case for their position.
Yes, yes.
That, so there's a temptation.
I'm glad we're going this way, because I do think what Rebecca's about to say is a crucial part of how these conversations go off the rails almost immediately. So just want to pause, really tune into this part, because it's pretty significant.
Yeah, and I think it can happen both in private conversations and in public conversations, where especially if we feel passionately about something, mm-hmm. and we should, like the many things we should feel passionately about, it's easy for us to just want to go quickly to, this is why you're wrong.
Yeah.
What a stupid idea.
Yeah.
How can you be so foolish as to think that? Or how can you be so morally corrupt as to think that?
Yeah.
Instead, what we need to say is, okay, here are all the kind of good reasons, the potentially like strong evidence that does point to the conclusion that you have drawn here.
Yeah.
You know, we've talked in the past, for instance, about the question of abortion, which is, you know, profoundly emotionally charged question.
Sure.
Around which I think both of us have very strong convictions, pro-life convictions. But if I'm talking with a friend who does not believe that infants in the womb at the earliest stage even are human beings made in the image of God, what I'll want to say to them is not like, you must be a terrible baby murderer. Mm-hmm. What I want to say to them is, I understand the really hard situations that you care profoundly about. I understand your like deep moral concern and compassion for victims of rape, for very young girls who find themselves pregnant, potentially through no choice of their own, even the kind of really painful life and death scenarios that are exposed by this issue. And I feel the moral weight of that. And I recognize the goodness of your concern and care in these situations. I recognize also the goodness of your concern and care that women should be respected as moral agents in their own right and should be treated as equal participants in society with men. Like I recognize all of these good things. And yet, like with all of those things taken into account, here is why I, as a Christian, profoundly believe that the unborn child is a human being made in the image of God whose life deserves to be protected.
Right.
But I need to recognize those things first, not because this is an agree to disagree issue, not because this is an issue where there's like, you know, where I don't think there's like a clear answer, but because I need to understand the other person has come to their conclusion, most likely also after serious consideration and with some sort of strongly held moral convictions, at least some of which I can come alongside them in and say, yes, that is a good moral conviction to have. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to make the best, we need to sit with and acknowledge and listen to and even help to construct the best case for the opposing view to ours. And then explain why we actually think that best case is not a satisfying answer.
Yeah.
I think we need to do both of those things. Ever since Jesus's female followers were the first to witness his resurrection, women have been sharing the message of Jesus with those who have never heard it. In his new book, 10 Women Who Changed the World, seminary president Daniel L. Akin tells the stories of 10 women in particular who were called by God to serve as missionaries all across the world. As I've studied missions and read missionary biographies over my lifetime, Akin writes, I've been amazed and inspired by the large number of women who left home, families, comfort and safety in obedience to Jesus and his command to go to the nations with his gospel. Their number is far greater than most realize. You can find out about a handful of these stories in 10 Women Who Changed the World, which is available wherever books are sold.
I think that one of the temptations for well-meaning Christians in these conversations is to kind of lead with the prophet's edge of just like, I have to call the thing what it is. And that's, there are times when we have to call a thing what it is. And that's a part of a respect for the other person of going like, listen, it's wrong for me to not call this thing what it actually is and to acknowledge that we do not agree about it. Mm-hmm. there are also times when we need to just hold off a little bit and just listen a little while longer. And that's with conversations with other Christians. It's conversations with non-Christians. Ask thoughtful questions. You know, I don't know whether it was Tim Keller or Will Edgar. It was one of those guys in a classroom I was in 10 years ago who said, I am not ready to move forward in responding or broaching or talking through the area of disagreement until I can state my conversation partner's position in such a way where they would go, yes.
Yeah, it's definitely something Tim Keller does say. Maybe Bill Ecker as well, yeah.
That's what I believe and why I believe it.
Yeah.
And that was such a helpful moment for me because it is so easy. It's easier now than it's ever been to just go, let me just castigate this person for a position that I kind of loosely, maybe murkily, possibly think they hold.
Yeah.
And when we do that, I think it's important to acknowledge it cheapens our position. And I do think it's one of the areas where we fall into in conversation, particularly online, but anywhere else as well. We cheapen our position if we have to hold it against the weakest form of a position that somebody doesn't hold.
Yeah.
Because real, like, conversation partners, I'm not talking about bad faith actors. Bad faith actors are bad faith actors. And it doesn't, like Proverbs says, answer a fool according to its folly, their folly, and then says, don't answer a fool according to their folly. Mm-hmm. Why does it say both? Because Proverbs isn't giving you moral imperatives. It's giving you wise instruction and trusting that sometimes you'll go, not going to deal with this. Like, this is not a fool that I'm going to answer according to their folly. This is a fool I'm going to answer according to their folly. But you are foolish in your conversation if you go, let me pit the strongest form of my argument for this position against the weakest form of the opposite.
Yeah.
Because that will only work with simpletons and with people who are really not interested in change or transformation.
I love that you use the word simpletons, Kyle.
I mean—
Is that a common word in Texas? Simple.
It's a common word in my mind in conversation. But I do think that sometimes we imagine, oh yeah, they won't be able to see through this smokescreen. And it's like, no, they will. And if you convince somebody with a simple answer, do you know what will happen? They will truly meet the substantive counterposition to what you've said, and they'll go, that person, the other person lied to me.
Yeah.
If we give, and I feel this with students, college students in particular, I feel like a lot of these college students that were raised in churches were given these very simple pat on the head ways of answering objections, where these objections were just dealt with kind of just like so dismissively, so paternalistically, like, how could anybody? This is so easy. You know, you think about something like evolution, okay? And that's just an easy one because it's a big one, right? It's a big one that's been in the conversation since there was a formal apologetics conversation. And a lot of Christians are just trained in such a way where they just are like, yeah, well, evolution is just people who believe we came from monkeys, full stop. How dumb is that? And that's what I heard in a well-meaning church among well-meaning people. And the reality is that, like, hey, there's some pretty thoughtful people that have a more substantive response than evolution is just, I think we came from monkeys. Now, I'm not somebody who holds an evolutionary view of the human person, but if I'm going to faithfully articulate my position, I can't articulate a non-evolutionary view of the human person by looking at the evolutionary view and being like, they're all just people who think we came from monkeys. It's not going to hold up.
I think that's a great example, and it's a particularly good example because, number one, as you say, many supposedly Christian articulations of why they are not persuaded by an evolutionary account of origins mostly reveal that the Christian has not understood what the scientific claim even is, which, you know, it's not a great starting place. And secondly, because there's often a failure to distinguish between various different kinds of view.
Yes,
Another one of my wise seminary teachers said, when it comes to any heresy in the church in the last sort of 2,000 years, one of the things that theologians have had to do is to say, we must distinguish between A and B, which looks actually very similar to A, but is different for this reason. I think that's true whether we're talking about kind of, you know, serious heresies or whether we're talking about different, you know, a range of different kinds of questions that may or may not draw us into heresy. When it comes to evolution as a question, we need to recognize that there are some, you know, there are some atheists and some Christians who are saying that if the evolutionary account of human origins is scientifically true, then that gives an entire account of who human beings are. And so from an atheist perspective, it would just say, you know, that discredits any claim that Christians might make about human beings being, for example, made in the image of God.
Right.
And from a Christian perspective, it's people saying, well, anyone who holds to evolution couldn't possibly also believe that there is a God who created humans through this process. And actually, you know, we need to recognize that there are multiple, you know, potential options in this conversation. And it's not just a like completely sort of naturalistic, atheistic account on the one hand and a completely sort of supernaturalistic account on the other, that actually there's all sorts of stuff happening in between. But just to go back to the process that we might go through, because the reality is, I mean, all of us, we have a lot of emotions flooding around our bodies, whether we are aware of them or not. And on questions and issues that we feel passionate about, very often our emotions get into the driving seat, even when we think we're being incredibly rational.
Yep.
And so one thing I find helpful, both in private conversations and in public conversations, is to go, if I feel, especially if I feel my emotions sort of starting to rise up and want to take the driving seat, is to go through a little bit of a four-part process. So as I'm engaging with somebody with whom I profoundly disagree, number one, I want to listen. Mm-hmm. Number two, I want to affirm what I can of what they're saying and how they come to these conclusions.
Yep.
Number three, going back to what you were saying about Tim Keller, I want to restate their position. I'm going to say, like, if I've understood you correctly, what you are saying is this. Please tell me if that's not actually fairly representing what you're saying.
Yep.
And then I want to explain why I actually don't think that that is the most satisfying account of the situation. So listen, affirm, restate, explain. I wish it spelled a word.
I know. I was immediately Lair. In my head.
L-A-R-E? Lair.
Yeah. Lair. Yeah, that's not a good one. No, it's not. Like Lear.
Yes. Or you'd think it was spelled L-A-I-R. Yeah. Anyway, listen, affirm, restate, explain can just help me in that moment think, okay, what point am I in this process? Have I properly listened? Because it doesn't just matter what agnostics in general think about this question or what Muslims in general think about this question. What matters in the conversation is, what does this particular person who may identify as agnostic, Jewish, Muslim, atheist, whatever, what do they think? And how am I going to engage with them?
Yes. And I do think that is right. What you just said there is also another really crucial part of meaningful engagement around big ideas, which is to realize that when you're talking to a person, if you start to associate them with a meta position right out of the gate, like, well, you're just a liberal. Okay. Well, like, yeah, maybe the person falls under a broad swath of what can be considered political liberalism. But we're talking about these huge categories, right? That are ginormous. And when we're in a conversation with a person, we have the unique opportunity to kind of put that in, not in the foreground, but in the background, and go, let me foreground the individual here and talk with them through this. I do think sometimes we can almost do this quick fire diagnostic, right? It's almost like we're trying to put them into a camp immediately when we have an opportunity to actually talk with a person.
Yeah.
And what the internet has done is it has created, I mean, it hasn't done this entirely. Certainly we lumped things together by categories far before the internet, but it's made this kind of ideological lumping so easy.
Yeah.
Like it's been so fast, which is like, there are a lot of people for whom the way you answer one question might be the only thing that they really use to sort where you fall on their index of respectability, of integrity, of character, of ideology. And I understand, and I fall into that temptation as much as anyone does. But when we are talking with a person, we have a responsibility in that conversation to give them the space to go, I don't want to assume that the way you answer this question will give me a determination for how you would answer every question.
Right.
And so I would encourage you, if you've been in a long relationship with somebody and you've kind of like categorized them or lumped them into an ideological school of thought to where you now have like a script that runs in your conversations where you've just stopped kind of engaging and being curious and thoughtful because you've already kind of decided this is how they think about all things, I'd really encourage you to call that into question because you might be surprised to find out that the script you have for how they might respond to every question that you could possibly ask them isn't actually accurate.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the word liberal is an interesting one at the moment because it seems that it is often being used by people who might consider themselves to be religious conservatives to discredit anyone who is challenging any of the ways in which they're thinking.
Yeah.
So, for instance, I mean, I have various times been accused of, because that's definitely the spirit in which it's done, accused of being liberal because I'm not infrequently talk about questions of race and the injustice towards Black Americans in Americans' history. Mm-hmm. And because people have typically heard those conversations from what they perceive to at least be a liberal direction, they then, you know, would want to categorize me as a liberal. Honestly, most of my friends who are actual liberals, like proper liberal folk, would laugh out loud at the idea that this pro-life person who believes in Christian marriage being male, female, and there are so many ways in which I actually would disqualify myself in the eyes of any of my liberal friends from membership of that group. But because often it is just a kind of lazy response to anyone whose ideas you might not want to hear, actually, that can become kind of knee-jerk. I think just to, you began this conversation was asking me about my time in Oxford, and much as I, you know, hate to bring up the other place again, one of the interesting experiences I had there was after, I think, the first talk I gave, a couple of students came up to chat. One, it was a science student, one was a philosophy student. And both of them had a lot of questions. They evidently didn't think that my answers were at all kind of satisfying to them. And the philosophy student in particular, you know, I gave him a copy of my book, Confronting Christianity, and he said he'd sort of skim read it for the pieces he was interested in and like very quickly, you know, definitely wanted to tell me why I was wrong, which is fine. And then somewhat to my surprise, he emailed me because I'd made myself available. Any student who wants to meet with me to talk further, I'd love to do that. Give people an email address. He emailed me to say that he would love to sit down and talk again. And I thought, oh, that's interesting because I would have thought from our first interaction, my assumption was he had thoroughly dismissed me as somebody who didn't know what they were talking about. Yeah. But I thought, do you know what? This young man who has a background in philosophy, you know, studying philosophy at Oxford, he has a lot of questions that I am honestly, as somebody who doesn't have a meaningful background in philosophy, I'm not going to be able to answer. Or even I'm not going to be able to speak his language sufficiently for him to feel like it's even worth asking me his questions. So what I did is I did a little bit of research. I found a Christian philosophy tutor at Oxford and I invited him. I said, hey, would you be interested in meeting the student? I said to the student, would you be interested in meeting with this Christian philosopher? They both said, yes, they'd love to. And so the three of us sat down in a pub and I mostly just kind of sat on the sidelines watching while they went back and forth about various questions. I think it's really helpful for us as Christians to be able to acknowledge when we're actually not necessarily the best person to engage with somebody else's objections to the Christian faith.
Yeah.
We may be like well out of our league or out of our depth in the particular area that they're interested in. And we may need to find somebody who actually, you know, shares our faith in Jesus, but has a much better background in that. And so I think it's fine to acknowledge when we don't know. Mm. And I think it's an opportunity for us to kind of field our whole team as Christians to say, you know, I don't know the answer to that question. And honestly, I probably wouldn't even have the background to give you a satisfying answer, even if I sat down and read some books, but I would love to connect you with somebody who might know more. And I think that there are opportunities we can have in our lives to do that in a whole range of ways. It may be that somebody doesn't have the right academic background. It may be that they don't have the right kind of personal experience background to really relate to somebody. And, you know, I sure. might say to somebody, yeah, I have never been through what you've been through. And I really understand how that's shaping your view of the Christian faith. Would you be interested in meeting my friend so-and-so who actually has had more similar experiences? Would you be interested in talking with them?
Yep.
So in there are ways in which we can kind of bring others into conversations that we may not be in the best position to have ourselves.
Yeah, no, I understand that. The whole time you were telling that story, think about that, I was thinking about in my own life, a unique situation that I found myself in. When we were just launching Mosaic Church, here in Richardson, I encountered a guy who just wandered in to a membership class that we were running, just wandered into it. And he was a Black guy, and he was talking about, he was talking a lot about how Black people are the true Israelites. They're the true mm-hmm. children of Abraham. And I was like, my head was spinning. I never heard anything he was talking about. And I was trying to engage with him. And the whole time he was like, well, you wouldn't possibly understand this. You know, you're part of the white devil, the white oppressor. I was like, whoa, okay, I am out of my depth here. But I'm just trying to engage compassionately. And I mean, he was a really smart guy, very articulate. And so we're having these conversations together. So I'm debriefing with some of my Black pastor friends. Okay, pastoring mm-hmm. predominantly Black communities.
Yep.
And I'm telling them about this story. And they go, yo. They're like, hey, listen, that's not your mission.
Right.
You need to connect one of us. Like, you're not going to be very effective at meaningfully engaging Black Hebrew Israelites, which turns out that's what this guy was a part of.
Very much so, yeah.
I did not know anything about it. It was my first mm-hmm. experience. And I was like planning to do like, let's follow up and we'll do coffee. You know, I'm doing like what I know to do. And my friends were like, no, this is give me his number. We'll talk with them, but this is not going to be your conversation to be in. And it was a good moment for me to be like, you know what? You're right. There are times whenever the church is the body of Christ. We are not all the best. Like, Paul was uniquely situated for the Gentile mission in the way that Peter was not. Peter still participated when God presented providential opportunities, but like, he did not have the same calling that Paul did. That is just clear. And it's okay sometimes for us to be in a situation where we're like, you know, I am maybe not the best person to address this, but I know somebody who could be helpful here. Mm-hmm. And let's go to them together. Let's think through that. You don't have to be the, like, I think sometimes Christians see themselves as like, I've got to give an answer for the hope that is within me means that every question that comes up, I've got like the ready-made like answer. It's sitting in my spiritual Tupperware box and I can pull it out and it's still fresh and it always tastes good and it's palatable. And that's not the case. Sometimes you just go, yeah, I'm not so sure about that either. Let's explore it together.
Yeah.
Or let's go talk with somebody who maybe could talk about this with more substance. And that's an important part of the conversation as well. So what do you feel like, Rebecca? What do you feel like is the, or what do you think right now is the conversation that Christians have the best opportunity to disagree well with the dominant cultural narrative? Like, which is one that particularly right now you feel like we've got everything we need to disagree well with this particular objection, accusation, or cultural narrative. We've got all of the right framework and infrastructure. Don't abandon your birthright as a Christian. Just use what we have with this conversation.
Gosh, I basically feel that about every single every single sort of apologetic issue, that if only we realized what we had, we would be in an extraordinarily strong position. I mean, science is one of them, and this episode isn't about science, but I think we actually have a very strong case there. Not a case that pulls us away from science, but a case for saying actually a Christian understanding of the world gives the best foundation for modern science.
Yeah.
I think when it comes to what leads to human thriving, it's so interesting. I was talking with my 12-year-old yesterday, who's in middle school, and all around her are kids who have been told, what you need to do is look into yourself, figure out your own unique identity, and mm-hmm. pursue that at all costs. Like, you, that's where your ultimate fulfillment is going to be found. Find out who you are, make sure everybody else acknowledges what that is and go from there.
Right.
And instead, like by contrast, I'm raising my kids to believe that they are beautiful human beings made in the image of God, who are also profoundly corrupted by sin.
Right.
And who desperately need Jesus's forgiveness. And you could say, you know, and Richard Dawkins was sort of keen to say this, that raising kids to be Christians is like a form of child abuse. Like, how could you say, how could I tell my children, actually, rather than being like beautiful and innocent on the inside, you're actually like so corrupted by sin that you needed Jesus' death on the cross to save you. Like, that seems, intuitively, it seems like that would make sense, that it was a sort of psychologically damaging thing to say to your children.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out, like both in the lived experience that I can kind of see around me and my daughter can see around her, and in terms of the psychological evidence, raising kids in an actively religious context, like going to church every week, is far better for their mental health than raising them in a secular environment and telling them actually what you most need to do is figure out who you are. That is destroying a generation of young people today who are unraveling. Because when I look inside of me, what I find there isn't that unique and isn't that interesting. if I just kind of keep the spotlight on my own self, it's deadening. If I pursue my own happiness, I end up profoundly miserable. But if instead I recognize, no, I'm not the center of the universe. There is a God who is, and orienting myself around him, even when it means saying no to my desires and no to what feels sort of instinctive to me in various ways, and living for the sake of others primarily rather than for my own fulfillment, that turns out to be the path to psychological flourishing for humans.
Yeah.
So that's an area where I think Christian, like biblical ethics and the kinds of counterintuitive calls that the Bible makes upon us turn out to be borne out by the discoveries of modern psychology, which has found, you know, shock horror, that being more concerned to serve others than yourself turns out to be for your good psychologically. That giving does turn out to be more blessed than receiving, even sort of financially. That living with a kind of individualistic mindset, it turns out to be less conducive to human flourishing than having a kind of a strong sense of community and responsibility towards those in our community. Turns out that living according to Christian sexual ethics is profoundly good for us. And having multiple like serial sexual partners for humans in general, and in fact, especially for women, turns out to be profoundly negative in terms of its psychological consequences for us. So there are all sorts of ways in which actually the things the Bible was telling us 2000 years ago are borne out by the findings of modern psychology, including the goodness of going to church every week.
Yep. That's a good one. I think for me, and I know that we've talked about this before, it's the questions around injustice. There is such a push for justice and for the dignity of peoples. And I just feel like I just sometimes feel myself shouting, I feel like into the void of like, give me another story or worldview that has been going against the grain from its very inception to argue for the like for communal justice in the way that the Christian story has.
Yeah.
There is not one. Nowhere in the history of the world, the history of civilization, do you find one that's been as globally transmissible.
Yeah.
And as consistent with just a call to everybody's creating the image of God and they should be treated with dignity, and injustice is a problem.
Yeah, and actually so the British historian Tom Holland points out at great length in his mighty book, Dominion, How the Christian Revolution Remade the World, even the desire for justice among our non-Christian friends, or perhaps you're not a Christian, you're listening in here, your deep desire for justice and equality and for care for the poor, for love across racial difference, for believing in the equality of men and women, for against child abuse, all of these things have actually come from Christianity. And only in Jesus are those desires going to be satisfied.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Hey, also too, this is totally unrelated to our conversation. Do you ever listen to his podcast, The Rest is History?
No, but yeah, I was thinking only just this morning that I should.
It's so good, Rebecca.
Yeah, I believe it.
My
guilty secret is I hardly listen to any podcasts. I'm like really not a podcast person, but I need
It's okay. Well, listen.
Does it make me a hypocrite though? If I'm doing a podcast? Yeah,
call back to another episode. No, I don't think it does. I think a good place to land here is what you said, you shared though. There's four things. Like, so when you're in a conversation with somebody, we want to listen. Mm-hmm. We want to
affirm what we can and what they're saying. It won't be everything.
We want to restate.
Yep. In the best, strongest possible way.
And then we want to explain.
Explain why we disagree and why we think there's a more compelling other answer. Lair. You heard it first. Lair.
L-A-R-E. You heard it. Is that going to find its way into one of your books? That acronym?
Maybe. My next book's going to be on truth, so maybe.
There we go. Well, listen, hey, if you're looking for Confronting Christianity Online, you can find us on Instagram and Twitter. Leave a review over on iTunes, and in your review, include a question you want us to explore in a future episode. We'd be glad to do so. If you want to find out how we make podcasts like this happen, you can go to trainingthechurch.com/support. You can find out some other cool behind-the-scenes stuff over there. We hope you enjoyed the discussion today. Grace and peace.